Hey, I'm launching a book right now. If you love fantasy, sci-fi, beautiful books, stories about fantastical creatures, then go join the Kickstarter for Labyrinth. It's live right now. In fact, we've just blown past 2,000 backers in under a week, way faster than I anticipated. Thank you so much. But we can do 3,000. I know we can. Hit those stretch goals. More art, a better book with your help. Some characters don't get to be people. Some characters are weapons. Some are brainwashed from birth to be the perfect killing machine. Others are literally invented in a lab. Some are broken down to not even see themselves as people and leave only the deadly weapon. And a few even make themselves into the weapon. But they all have one thing in common. They're incredibly powerful while fighting a sense of powerlessness in their own lives. And under it all is someone asking themselves, who am I? What am I? Part 1. I am become death, destroyer of worlds. Memory is pain. Memory is weakness. Memory is the chain that binds us. I'm human. A stripped down version. Faster, more efficient, less encumbered by trivia. Trivia? I took a drag on my cigarette. Like morality, love, free will. She laughed, long and genuine. We're goddamn gangsters, she said. Not first-year philosophy students. Morality from the man who just murdered 50. Fuck the hypocrite's game. Free will, there's no such thing. Just the streets' endgame. All of it. The streets. The language of the streets isn't Confucius. It's violence. I am merely the instrument of that language, like a calligrapher's pen. This is from Tian Apa's fantastic book, The Escher Man, from a woman who erased her own history, her memories, her childhood, her family, anything which could make her empathetic, which could get in the way of vengeance, of hardening her. She altered her body with a combat system which makes her lightning quick and deadly, but which can also kill her prematurely. She refined herself into a weapon. These characters are so interesting because they're underpinned by this constant struggle between power and personhood, this tension. The alterations these characters make are, in a way, improvements, but they're also a sacrifice. Lin gives up her morality, her love, her free will, or much of it in a sense, viewing them as impediments to her real desire, survival and victory and vengeance in a world like this. In Cyberpunk Edgerunners, David becomes a killing machine, handing himself over to the Sandevistan and gives up his grip on reality in order to protect those he cares about most and find some sense of purpose for himself, even glory. In both of these stories, these characters giving more and more of themselves over to the weapon solves some problem in the plot, but creates others, other anxieties for us as the reader, as we see them do it to themselves, alienating friends, losing their sense of self, becoming dependent on violence, and ultimately, even an early death. That tension doesn't lend itself to a happy ending, to the point that these characters often feel tragic in the classical sense of the word. They might resolve the plot, but in doing so, sacrifice everything that truly mattered to them or that we cared about in them. But at the same time, remaining true to yourself but being powerless can be equally tragic, a recipe for disaster. Living weapon characters can be fascinating as antagonists because they're either utterly unstoppable forces of nature, empty of any humanity, who keep the story tense, or we inherently sympathize with them despite their brutality because we can see that someone made them what they are. These characters are also really fascinating as protagonists because they're active, driven, and they're constantly facing interesting moral dilemmas. And yet, the cruel irony of both David and Lin's stories is that each of these characters feel powerless, and weaponizing themselves becomes a way to reclaim some sense of agency in their world, even if it's a warped sense of agency. David lives in the repressed cyberpunk dystopia of Night City and takes on all these upgrades to provide for his friends, but that good desire destroys him. Lin lives in a version of Vietnam under the boot of Chinese occupation, and vengeance and violence itself is a kind of agency, the ability to assert oneself. Character arcs are often built around learning to let go of what you want, like vengeance, in favor of what you need, like therapy. But a lot of these characters exist in worlds where what they need doesn't really feel like an option. Lynn rejects the idea that free will even exists in her world, that it can't exist in a world so broken. You can't be free, not truly, but you can find a more elegant and powerful place in this twisted world, describing herself merely as an instrument of the language of violence, a calligrapher's pen. That there's some kind of nobility in that. David succumbed to his own hubris, choosing power and deluding himself into believing he could retain his personhood, that he was different to everyone else. This dilemma, this tension, drives a lot of Living Weapon stories, and how you resolve it as the writer says a lot about how you view both power and personhood, and the themes that you're weaving into your world, especially if you consider whether you want to give your character a positive arc or a negative arc. You can make it a cautionary tale, a tragedy, or a story of finding humanity in dark places. But the inverse of all of this is the character who has been made into a weapon by someone else. Violet Evergarden is a light novel series by Kana Akatsuki about a girl raised as the perfect soldier, a ruthless killer during the Great War. She believes her only value is in her capacity to follow orders, to kill, to forsake any need of her own for the cause. Legally, she's not even a person, just an extension of her owner, a tool. But the thing about tools is that they have a time, a place, a function, and what happens when you take a tool out of that? Because one day, the war ends. The narrative forces Violet into a situation where everything that she was told she was just doesn't really apply anymore. It forces that internal conflict to the surface. Am I still a killing machine? Am I just a killing machine? One of the best ways to really explore a character is to take away the thing they really define themselves by, their strengths, their weaknesses, their skills, and ask what remains, what else they can become, good or bad. Or alternatively, to give a character something big, an opportunity where none of the rest of that stuff really applies anymore. This is actually a technique that George R. R. Martin employs a lot in his writing. You see it with Jamie, with Theon, with a lot of characters. The technique applies to any character, but it's especially relevant to Living Weapons because their sense of identity is so often limited by circumstance. It's often controlled and deeply manipulated, and their skill sets are often very extreme. How many times have you seen the Living Weapon be incredibly deadly in combat, but utterly socially awkward? Violet Evergarden was never allowed to be anything but a weapon inside the war, so giving her a job as an auto-memory doll, basically someone who writes letters for others, fundamentally challenges every assumption and belief she has about herself. Being ruthless and unempathetic, once considered a strength, is now a weakness, but her meticulous attention to detail and dedication to duty gives her a new context to thrive in. That skill takes on new meaning and thus becomes a way for her to imagine herself differently. And we get to see that conflict play out because she manages to piss off both the sender and the recipient of one of the first letters she sends at the same time. She nearly gets fired until she agrees to take a training class, which she also fails. She experiences loss and love and trepidation and wonder vicariously through the letters she writes. Radical shifts in circumstances like this force characters to solve problems and fail and succeed in new ways, and that's how we come to understand people. 36 Streets actually does almost the opposite of this, wherein after taking everything from Lynn, it forces her into a situation where becoming the weapon feels like the only way out. Alternatively, you can have them in the same context, doing the same stuff where their strengths do apply, but the consequences are radically different. Like if a Living Weapon character is told to go and assassinate a bunch of people, but then they accidentally end up killing a child, this can shift their relationship with their own strengths and weaknesses and skills. It can alter their relationship to violence and foreshadow their turn to good, which is very common for these types of characters. But I think the other thing that attracts us to these types of characters is that they inherently drag a lot of complication and tension into the plot, simply by being so powerful in and of themselves. David naturally gets caught up in this conflict because he uses this Sandevistan, this weapon which everyone wants, this exoskeleton, so everyone is after him. Lynn immediately rockets up through this underworld chain of command by becoming so deadly. And in fact, the Isherman ends up being kind of like drawn to her for this reason. Violet feels like a social time bomb waiting to go off. The extremes of these characters naturally draw interest to them. I take a very pragmatic approach to writing. I like to understand it technically. That's what these videos are about. But you might not know that I also write professionally. I have been for years on the side. I've written for fantasy games, I've published fiction professionally, and that's all great, but I wanted to do something bigger, and so I did. We're calling it Labyrinth. Imagine a world where art is magic, and where magic comes from this gargantuan jellyfish in the sky. This is the world of my epic fantasy story, and you can read it in Labyrinth. Except, what's even cooler is it's not just me. We brought together some of the biggest names in epic fantasy, like ML Wong, Ryan Cahill, and even Christopher Paolini. As in, yeah, the Christopher Paolini we all grew up reading. A collection of stories themed all around fantastical, magical creatures, a dash of sci-fi on the side, and it's only on Kickstarter for this month at the link below. If you're late to this video, time is running out. There is a reason Labyrinth is special. We're calling this Labyrinth Volume Zero because we want Labyrinth to be something we can do again, to create a magazine, a journal you can submit to, you can be published with, paid at professional rates, nominated for awards. Who knows? I love elevating other writers and artists who deserve to be seen more. That's what I do in my job. And while the initial volumes will be by invitation, this is something we can do if we pull this off on Kickstarter. I want HFM to be a place we don't just go to learn, but to create. We've blown past 2,000 backers already in under a week, but to make this happen, we need to aim higher. I would love to hit 3,000 backers. It's ambitious, I know, but if just 1% of the people watching this video back it, we will do that. Not to mention, more backers means a better book. Labyrinth is designed inside and out by Wraithmark, who specialize in these gorgeous deluxe books, so it comes with these beautiful illustrations like this one from Erica Williams. I mean, just look at this gorgeous cover art by Andrew Thompson. And if we hit our stretch goals, I'll be able to bring on my favorite artist of all time, Aria Forn, whose work is ethereal and wonderful and strange and weird, and I mean, just look at it, it's amazing. And because HFM has always been about learning, you actually get a behind the scenes look at how all of this art and some of the stories were made step by step, all in Labyrinth. And you can get pins and prints if you like those, only available during the Kickstarter. If you enjoy my videos, or if you just love amazing fantastical creatures like I do, because that was where it all started, then go get Labyrinth right now. To borrow from Star Wars, we are on the verge of greatness and doing something meaningful. Join the Kickstarter at the link below.
There is always more magic in the world for those willing to open their eyes. Stories of magic, the stars, and fantastical creatures. With authors you know and love, and so many more. All in one book. This is Labyrinth, Volume Zero. Join the Kickstarter now.
Part 2. What does it mean to be human? We're 36 streets in the Yesha Man have characters asking whether they are still human and whether that matters at all on their way to becoming a weapon. Violet Evergarden has a weapon discovering what it means to be human for the first time. So it's no wonder that these characters are brilliant vehicles for exploring that theme as they lose and rediscover new parts of themselves. Lynn insists that memory is, quote, pain and weakness, and so part of being human is our softness, our vulnerability to the past. But Nappa also asserts that, quote, without memory, we lose the vitality of our resistance. In other words, memory is both a strength and a weakness for humanity, but is a weakness we should want. In Violet Evergarden, she slowly understands what it means to love, to care, to be alone, and to find company, but it also means facing up to our wrongs and our sins. Quote, you don't realize your body is on fire and burning up because of the things you did. You'll understand one day, and then you'll realize for the first time that you have many burns. In Blade Runner 2049, where K is basically designed to be a hitman to kill his own people, he initially believes that being physically born of a woman is what makes you human. But as he emerges from seeing himself as a weapon to being a person, that real discussion is about what it means to remember and feel something authentically. Because he has these fake memories implanted in his head, and yet they're what motivates him. They feel real to him, and of course, none of us truly remember our past perfectly. All of our feelings, our perception of reality, can be manipulated. Does that make us less real? The beautiful irony of these stories is that these characters who are often treated as less than human, treated as tools, are the ones who seem the most human to us. And in fact, narratively, how we see ourselves in these characters can say a lot about how we understand what it means to be human as well. And you can manipulate that through perspective as the writer. In Blade Runner, almost every human character is cynical and cruel or detached from reality, while the replicants are driven by hope and wonder and childlike familial attachment and self-sacrifice.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Ten Hauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. Time to die.
What is more human than wanting to be witnessed before we shuffle off this mortal coil? To be human is to be noticed. In this Living Weapon story, humanity isn't something we're born with, but something we give each other, and thus something we take from each other, and which these characters have usually been denied. They have not been noticed. Consider how you might address this question as your character descends into becoming a weapon or ascends out of it into becoming human. Is violence an inherent part of human nature? Is pain? These characters might feel liberated from their past, but being human doesn't mean you're free. In what ways are we still controlled by our emotions, by our society, or as Napa suggests, by our own memory? And is being human even the thing we should aspire to most? Is it even a dilemma to choose between power and humanity? This is also why, narratively, Living Weapon stories tend to go hand in hand with revenge stories. Characters realizing they've been used, dangerous people of immense power finally choosing something for themselves, a lot of suppressed emotions they may not be able to healthily cope with, the cocktail has to go somewhere. And that desire for freedom and agency can often manifest in them turning on the people who created them, sometimes even replacing them. But there is another side to this thematically, because like becoming a weapon, like power, revenge can be a dehumanizing force. It is something we sacrifice parts of ourselves to, our morality, our free will. Lynn's story is fundamentally one of vengeance, and in 36th Street she believes, quote, "Vengeance is an assertion of one's place in the cosmos. It focuses one's intent." And yet, ironically, we also see how she describes herself as the, quote, "instrument of the language of the streets, of violence, the calligrapher's pen." This contradiction is thematically fascinating to me because in asserting herself against the cosmos, she is utterly subsumed by it. No longer a person, so much as part of the wallpaper of this terrible world. Just as often as these characters can explore what it means to find our humanity, they can explore how giving into our baser instincts makes us less human. Consider how these ideas might play out in your story, this tension between a desire for agency and this attachment to power and maybe vengeance. For someone who might have sidelined their emotions in order to be a weapon, how are they not enslaved to their emotions when they finally open up to them? We spoke before about how a radical shift in circumstances can motivate this kind of change, but a lot of the time that change comes from a part 3 breaking point. Something in her little head had snapped, undoubtedly caused by all the blood she had spilled. They never should have expected so much from her. They would have to fix her. She carried the memories of what she had done, and there was nothing he could do to help her with that. For a child to have committed such atrocities, there was sure to be permanent damage in her spirit, in her soul. This is from Milo James Fowler's The Last Human Child, a beautiful story about a kid called Dahlia who was molded into the perfect killing machine, a weapon to end an apocalyptic war where humans are dying out as toxic rain renders the species infertile. She slaughters her enemies in this legendarily bloody night, but she also turns on her creators, the humans who made her. She snaps. Everyone else in the story is bewildered. They see this child breaking under the stress of violence, but we get to see what really happened, because before Dahlia slaughtered everyone, she was kidnapped by a genetically engineered creature working for the enemy called Braunstone, and he, of all people, was kind to her. For a character who had been a weapon or a tool, suddenly becoming a friend, an ally, or someone to be cared for radically changes how we can imagine ourselves, and so she snaps. This dynamic is very familiar to a lot of Living Weapon stories. Characters who have been conditioned into their state with a twisted kind of love or affection, a father, a mentor, a mother, and they trick themselves into believing that this person who makes them do all of this has a good reason, that behind it all, they do truly love them, even if they don't fully understand it. They trust in that. It's no coincidence, I think, that these stories often explore abusive dynamics, especially within families. Children of abusive or manipulative parents will often reframe their abuse as part of a strange kind of love, a love which nobody else gets, which is rare and precious and scarce, and only they have earned through what they've done. And so the breaking point for these characters, like Dahlia, is when they kind of have to face that this love that they believed in, that they kind of depended on, isn't real. Not in the way they thought. Because what does that make you? A victim? No, you've been told your whole life about how strong you are. Your strength is how you defined yourself. Weakness was purged from you. Dahlia, being with Braunstone, though, shows her what real kindness is. And if that's real kindness, then what was everything she suffered through before at the hands of her creators? What was it for? I killed the elders, and those humans who raised me. I killed all of them. She shook her head, staring into the flickering light. I deserve to be hunted. They should kill me for what I did. Even here, we see that reflective desire to take the blame upon themselves, to shoulder the guilt, to believe they deserve the violence, the abuse that they are at the hands of. These are characters who are both powerful and struggle with a feeling of powerlessness, realizing they were even more powerless in their own lives than they thought, that they didn't even have the love of their abusers, that they couldn't even pull on those strings. This can happen slowly or all at once. Obviously, it's more dramatic narratively to have it happen all at once in these violent outbursts, but it can happen slowly, and perhaps that's more complex and interesting, because when that house of cards comes down, you have to go back and recontextualize your past, their actions, and your actions, all that violence you committed, and that's hard. And so it's no surprise the Living Weapon switches sides because the bad dudes at least treat them better. Which itself says something about your good guys. With Dahlia, what was the point of slaughtering all of the elders if the humans weren't the good guys? What's the point of this war? Suddenly, doesn't that make her a murderer? Oftentimes, the moral and emotional architecture that conditioned them to be the weapon is the only thing keeping them from feeling guilty. The snap often takes the plot in an entirely new direction and can even be the inciting incident which sets the plot in motion, their character arc, their character struggles, the tension that we get to explore. It changes the stakes and it changes where the tension lies. Not only with them asking who they are now, what they can be, but also setting them in opposition with whoever they killed and whoever they've, in a sense, betrayed. It can shift the focus from maybe completing the mission to vengeance or even switching sides. But the point is, the Living Weapon snapping is a great narrative opportunity which has naturally high personal stakes and plot stakes, especially when they are an object of power within the story. So if you're constructing a moment like this, ask yourself, what would break your character more than anything? What would undermine their most fundamental beliefs about themselves and their understanding of what they've done and their history and the situation that they're in? What would challenge that? Is the weight of that realization too hard to carry that instead they double down and they really commit to what they're doing? Or do they try to unpack it all? Does it just become a niggling in the back of their mind? That's kind of what happens to Lynn, by the way, the doubling down. She is broken by the world and hardens herself into a weapon rather than face the trauma of her past. And again, a lot of the time, the snapping is big and violent and dramatic, but I think one of my favorite examples of a Living Weapon snapping is actually Shinji from Neon Evangelion Genesis. It's not a bloody massacre. Instead, it's this, I kid you not, still silent shot for an entire minute of Shinji holding Kaworu up in a strangling grip after receiving orders to kill him. This one person who actually showed him what kindness, unconditional love was meant to look like, and he's meant to end him. He hesitates for a whole minute before carrying out the order. I actually thought my phone was broken when I first saw this, but I've never seen anything else like it. This moment of kind of just like paralyzing realization, paralyzing fear and brokenness of a person coming undone all at once. It's because of all this, Living Weapon characters are great avenues to explore what we do for love, for family, for friends, and how easily these things can be weaponized against us, as well as how dangerous it can make people when they are stripped of all of that, of the one thing which might have really sustained them. Sometimes the most powerful choice a Living Weapon can make, though, is to leave violence behind entirely, this thing which they have defined defined themselves by and that everyone else has defined them by for their entire life. Perhaps leaving it behind and not engaging with it at all is the only way that they can actually rediscover themselves. In The Last Human Child, this is what she sort of does. It becomes an active rebellion against the world which made her. But these plot beats, especially switching sides, creates a narrative challenge. You know how when you unlock like the bad guy at the end of a game and you get to play as them, but then you do and they've just been nerfed to hell and they're nowhere near as cool? It's not uncommon for a living weapon switching sides to feel a bit like that. You know, you suddenly throw this uber powerful character into the ensemble and to keep up the tension, writers will like nerf them in some way. It's just less compelling. I've got two videos on fight scenes and on overpowered characters, which I think will be really helpful resources for this. Go check those videos out. But to give you some simple ideas here, one, give the living weapon characters challenges which counter their strengths, like Violet having to be empathetic when she writes letters. Two, structure your fight scenes with multiple objectives, which allows several characters to play important roles, and it creates dilemmas during combat because, of course, the overpowered character probably can't be everywhere. Three, using their power might be dangerous in itself, creating a dilemma about whether it's worth the risk getting them involved. All of these are just way more interesting than nerfing them. The last kind of living weapon character is the kind who does not realize they are a weapon. Narratively, these characters can become a mystery, with their power slowly unfolding, it being a source of tension without them even realizing it. Sometimes we might know that they're powerful as the reader, but the characters around them don't. And if we know that they're dangerous, but others haven't quite seen it yet, we only see their potential for violence maybe, you can create this sort of sword of Damocles hanging over the head of the story. You know, this potential for violence that we know is going to explode at some point. All of this can make it really satisfying when eventually we do see them unleash their power, embrace it, or realize it. In Firefly and Serenity, it's continuously hinted that River is this incredible deadly weapon created by the Alliance, but it isn't really until the end of the film that we get to see her in full force. Throughout it, we get these hints, and she feels like a bit of a ticking time bomb, so when it finally goes off, it's not only a radical shift in the story and in the plot and kind of like what we're imagining is going on, but we get to see this character as a spectacle. And I say that because, let's be honest, a lot of living weapon characters are spectacles. They're fun to watch. They kill a lot of people. They're lightning quick. It's just a lot of fun to see them, good or bad. It's thrilling, heart-pumping to see a character at the full extent of their abilities, hero or villain, to see capable characters doing what they're good at. But it can also be devastating when the character, for example, has resisted violence or doesn't want to be violent, has to be violent in order to help their friends, or if they've worked a long time to not be violent, accidentally giving into that. That hurts. You can't take that back, in a sense. And so the question I want to ask you as the writer is a little bit behind that. It's a step behind the violence and the spectacle. How are we meant to feel about watching this? Is it meant to be a spectacle, or is it meant to be sad? Is it horror wrapped up in neon lights? Is it two battle axes being wielded by a child soldier? So you've got characters who make themselves into weapons or are made into weapons by others, but then there are characters who do not even realize they are weapons. Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card features a kid trained to be a godlike military commander who is tricked into slaughtering an entire alien race while he believes it to be a simulation. His breaking point, like Shinji, is very quiet. He doesn't spark a vengeful tirade. Instead, he sets out to make amends, and the sequel, Speaker for the Dead, involves a significant subplot of Ender trying to help the last former queen find a new place to live. And when faced with a new alien life form, he seeks to fully understand them and empathize with them before making any rash decisions, to allow himself to play any part in violence against people he doesn't fully understand. Don't just think about the most exciting plot way for the living weapon character to snap, but the most meaningful. Part 4, The Greater Evil. All of this brings us to a constant through line with all of these characters. They almost always exist in the shadow of some other character or organization, or even an entire world which created them. The Alliance, the Tyrell Corporation, the perditious streets of Hanoi, the Great War, humanity's prejudice. It's impossible for their journey of healing or revenge or switching sides to not be at least in some way a reflection on what created them. The Alliance is secretive and desperate need for control, the Tyrell Corporation's utter disdain for sentient life, the Chinese government's desire to rewrite history. 36th Street sees Lin find no real resolution, no happy ending, but it feels deeply intentional. Her journey to becoming a weapon is reflective of this violent world she's had to survive in, and of Vietnam's history in particular. See, the book is set in northern Vietnam following its occupation by China, and a lack of moral resolution, the inability to live at peace, is presented as an inherent part of life under occupation. How can she find resolution when Vietnam itself can't? It's still occupied, and the world itself is so caught up in this violence that she inevitably falls towards it. Napa also uses a fundamental part of her becoming a weapon, that is, erasing her memories and her past, as an analogue for Vietnam suppressing its own traumatic history of resistance. Centuries of fighting the Chinese, the French, the Imperial Japanese, the Americans, suppressing it with patriotic narratives, their own kind of lie. The monstrosity of what was done to our people, the industrial-scale murder, the deployment of technologies which reap grotesque distortions upon bodies and minds and nature itself, hidden, denied, wiped, forgotten. But the final act of forgetting is the most audacious and most necessary. We have to choose to do it. We must sleepwalk into the eternal present, without a past to guide us, without a dream of future to lead us. Only then will we be conquered. Without memory, we lose the vitality of our resistance, Lin. We lose the strength given to us, transmitted from our past. Like Vietnam, Lin suppression is not an effective way to survive and thrive in this world, merely a way for us to sleepwalk into an eternal present, leaving behind our traumas without really processing them. The greater evil is the bloody and eternal struggle Vietnam finds itself trapped in once more, constantly fighting from out under a new boot and wishing it need not remember all it has lost and suffered. Living Weapon characters play with big ideas, identity and trauma and memory and violence and freedom and agency, and all of these apply to a lot of other contexts. Consider whether you want to use them and their journey as some analog or reflection of a greater journey as well. No character exists in a vacuum. They exist in relation to other people, in relation to their setting, as all people do. And as you position your characters in their story, you're naturally going to be building themes. But these characters can also be fun and interesting and complex without some grand heel turn or what does it mean to be human story. Like, Master Chief has a very understated but quite emotive relationship with Cortana, an AI, another constructed being like himself and something akin to a love story. These stories are often less about pushing back against their conditioning and more about who they can be while still fulfilling their role as a weapon. Like, he never questions that. Part 5. The Chosen One is a Weapon. In Black Sun by Rebecca Roanhorse, Serapio is chosen as the vessel of the Crow God, molded into this Chosen One through ritualistic scarring and even blinding, not unlike the physical and mental alterations we've seen in every other story we've discussed today. Serapio and other characters in the story are almost unwillingly caught up in this divine conflict, plucked out of nothing and used as tools in the greater war at hand. Chosen Ones are, by nature, forged into weapons by others, by powerful entities, by will and fate and destiny for cosmological conflicts of which they had no real choice in. And yet, these stories are, interestingly, so often focused on the character setting aside their own desires and rising to meet this challenge, to accepting their role as the weapon. What makes Black Sun and other books interesting is how much of Serapio's arc actually comes down to him escaping being this weapon, the cost of letting go of this power, of breaking the chains of destiny and becoming someone else, someone he wants to be. It takes those assumptions that we have about the Chosen One and sort of turns it on its head. In a world of fallible gods, or even just a world of free-thinking humans, the question of whether that destiny, whether that power should be invested in a single person, and whether that should override your free will, your right to live at peace, is something we often don't really address in these stories. It's not all that different to The Last Human Child, you know, told they would end this war with the Spliced, nor with River and Serenity, that she would keep the Alliance safe. Part 6. Dehumanization. The overarching theme which comes through again in these stories over and over is dehumanization. And I want to talk about that because I think what makes these characters unique is how bodily that dehumanization often is. Having your body or your mind used against you is violating in a way that, say, throwing you in prison isn't. These characters often have little of themselves to retreat to, little of themselves that others aren't entitled to, and so freedom isn't just about, like, discovering who you want to be, but it's about carving out a sense of privacy, in a sense of boundaries, but we can capture that dehumanization in really interesting ways on a line-by-line level, and nobody's better for this than Margaret Atwood in The Handmaid's Tale, which isn't about someone turned into a weapon, but they are turned into a womb.
I used to think of my body as an instrument of pleasure or a means of transportation or an implement of the accomplishment of my will. There were limits, but my body was nevertheless lithe, single, solid, one with me. Now the flesh arranges itself differently. I'm a cloud, congealed around a central object, the shape of a pear, which is hard and more real than I am, and glows red within its translucent wrapping. Look at how she separates Offred's body from Offred as a person. It's spoken of as a separate object. It is more real than she is. She is alienated not only in her society, but in her own body, and even in the structure of Atwood's writing. The book also very intentionally refuses to reveal Offred's true name, Offred being the name given to her by the dystopian society of Gilead, meaning Offred, the man she is meant to serve. There becomes this level of alienation and dehumanization, even between her and us as the reader. If you're writing about a character rediscovering their identity, their sense of self, then maybe they're also rediscovering their own body. That part of this is about privacy. It's about putting up boundaries. It's about being able to withhold parts of themselves that they never could before. But if you're writing about being used by someone else, this level of dehumanization, then maybe consider abstracting their actions from their mind. One way to do this is actually with passive voice, which is typically regarded as bad writing because this is where the object is doing the thing rather than being acted upon. But it can be really interesting because if you say the man was killed as opposed to she killed the man, it creates this abstraction which almost kind of removes the choice from her. There are all sorts of interesting ways to do this. Ender's Game and Speak of the Dead resonate in part because of how Card employs narrative symmetry between our living weapon and the supposed antagonists, the Formics, the buggers. The aliens are dehumanized and later described as being as alive and wise as any man and whose genocide nobody thought to call a crime, and all of that dehumanization can kind of be exported and placed on Ender at the same time. This is how humans are. We question all our beliefs except the ones that we really believe in, and those we never think to question. Dehumanization is something in the sense which we do passively, which we do unthinkingly, and if that's the case, then humanization is something we have to actively put effort into. We have to choose to do. But because of that, the human mind is really good with coming up with ways to rationalize dehumanization. Why even interview us? Why toy with us? Because at least then they could allow themselves the delusion of compassion. This is from a story about synthetic humans who have to go through an interview in order to be granted human rights, in order to prove that they're sentient, not knowing that they are never going to succeed, and yet they still hold the interviews. Why? To placate and soothe their conscience, knowing what they're doing. The delusion of compassion, the way we still convince ourselves that what we're doing is somewhat okay in some way. The reason I bring this up is if you're placing a character in a world where dehumanization is something they face every single day, then the flip side of that is that delusion of compassion. It is how we rationalize that cruelty. It's how we rationalize that dehumanization despite being and believing we're fully human ourselves. And that passage is actually from a story that I wrote. It's being published in Diabolical Plots, I think. I don't know if it's out yet, but if you want to read my writing, then go get Labyrinth, I promise, because it's got so much more. But let's bring all this into a summary. One, Living Weapon characters explore the struggle between power and personhood. They can make fascinatingly imposing antagonists and compelling protagonists, with becoming the weapon often as a way to reclaim a sense of agency. Two, one of the best ways to explore a character is to force them into a situation where their strengths, weaknesses, and skills no longer really apply. Three, these characters often explore what it means to be human, especially as they lose or rediscover parts of themselves. Four, the breaking point is often triggered by exposure to some new thing, which brings down this house of cards they use to justify their violence and their abuse. This radical shift in the plot can force the story in a wholly new direction with high personal stakes. Use it. Five, revenge plays a huge role in these stories, but revenge, like power, like becoming a weapon, is a dehumanizing force a lot of the time. Six, given these characters play with big ideas of identity and violence and agency, consider how you can use them as a microcosm of broader issues in your world and story. Seven, dehumanization is a powerful force in these stories and their worlds. Think of how you can reflect that on a line-by-line level. Eight, go get Labyrinth. Stay nerdy, and I will see you on the Kickstarter.
Thank you.